The bus boycotts in Montgomery, Alabama brought together two civil rights icons, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Today, we visit the Rosa Parks Museum and the Civil Rights Museum to learn more about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More, where each week we bring you a new story about people, inventions, pop culture, and life. I'm your host, Russ, and this week we discuss Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. We start our story in Montgomery, Alabama, where we talk with Madeline Burkhart, the curator of the Rosa Parks Museum. The museum is located at Troy University, the site where Rosa Parks was arrested. Madeline, tell us about the day of that arrest.
On December 1st, 1955, Rosa Louise McCauley Parks, she was a seamstress at Montgomery Fair Department Store, right downtown Montgomery. After work, she boarded a bus about two blocks away from the museum, and she sat in a section that wasn't illegal for her to sit in. It was kind of not in the very back of the bus, but it wasn't in the front of the bus either. And on her way home, it was very, very crowded, and about a block and a half to two blocks down, a white man gets on the bus, asks her to move out of her seat, and she says no.
Many stories about this say that, well, she was working all day and she was tired, but that's not the real story.
It wasn't just that she was tired. She always said that, you know, the only tired she was tired of giving in.
Her act of sitting on the bus and her refusal to move caused the bus driver to call the police.
So the police come and they don't really ask her to get up. I mean, they do, but they also forcefully take her off the bus that day. She is arrested. She goes to jail. She's not there very long. And then the bus boycott kind of begins. Everything just kind of clicks into place. And, you know, almost 50,000 people start mobilizing within 4 days.
A group of ministers and civil rights leaders formed the Montgomery Improvement Association, led by a minister from the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, Martin Luther King Jr. They had three demands for the city.
Make sure that bus drivers are considerate. Black bus drivers are going through Black neighborhoods, and seating would be on a first-come, first-served basis.
The city did not accept these terms, so the protest went on. And then, in February, the city decided to call the protest illegal.
In February of 1956, 89 of the boycotters who were kind of instrumental to the organization of the boycott, there was an arrest warrant put out on them because of a 1921 statute that essentially said that it was illegal to cause financial pain to an organization.
Can you imagine that happening today? You know, there's this campaign to delete Facebook. Can you imagine being arrested for deleting Facebook? I mean, that's basically what these people are doing. They're just not purchasing the services. They're not using the bus, and they're being arrested for it.
The bus company was losing, I say, about $3,000 a day in 1955-56 money, which comes out to $9,000 in 2021.
So they were causing this financial damage to the bus company, and therefore they were arrested. They went to go turn themselves in, but before they did, they put on their Sunday bests, went to the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and took a photo.
They wanted to have on these really nice clothes is because the media was portraying them as no good thugs.
They were peaceful protesters. However, peaceful is not how both sides acted.
Exactly. So the boycotters were very peaceful. They were trained on, you know, not responding to rocks being thrown at them, their houses being bombed.
Even Martin Luther King Jr.'s house was bombed.
January 30th of 1956, he was speaking to a huge crowd of people at this mass meeting. So while that's going on, white supremacists went to Dr. King's house, the parsonage, and planted a bomb like under the porch area. And his wife, his 10-month-old baby daughter, and a friend from church were in the house. And they had just moved to the back of the house And then the bomb went off. And if they hadn't been in the back of the house, they would have been just instantly killed.
When the news reached where Martin Luther King Jr. was speaking, many of those that were in attendance came to his house. He gave a speech in front of his house telling everyone that you can't meet violence with violence. However, later that night, he had his doubts. He didn't want to put his family at risk, so he prayed.
He believed he heard a voice from God speaking to him and saying something like, you know, if you seek truth, justice, and equality, I'll be with you throughout all time. And that gave him the courage he needed to keep going and keep leading this movement. And you have to wonder if he had, you know, thrown in the towel that evening, if we would have made it 382 days, or if it would have ended, you know, January 30th, 1956, you know, 1 month in.
When we come back, we'll move from Montgomery to Memphis, where we'll learn more about Martin Luther King Jr. We'll also hear what Rosa Parks did later in her life. We'll be right back. We'll be starting up our podcast in just a second, but first, I have to tell you about Anchor. Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. And trust me, putting together a daily podcast can be difficult. Putting together any podcast can be difficult. So you want to take shortcuts wherever you can, and Anchor does that for you. They distribute your podcast so you could be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Also, they've got the editing tools right there on your phone and on your computer. Just download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. All right, we pick up our story in Memphis. We're talking with Dr. Noel Trent from the National Civil Rights Museum. Let's start with the bus boycott and Martin Luther King Jr.'s involvement in the bus boycott.
He joins the Montgomery boycott mostly because a lot of the other ministers were more established and they said, you know what, let's put the young guy out there, see what he can do. I mean, he had only lived in Montgomery for about a few months. So they were like, hey, if he gets run out of town, he can go back home to his dad. But the minute he gets involved, he becomes more dedicated to this work.
It's amazing that even after his home was bombed, he could still remain dedicated to this work. It's also amazing that he could still preach peace amongst everyone. He had a quote from his Stride Towards Freedom book.
Nonviolence means avoiding not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. You not only refuse to shoot a man, but you refuse to hate him, right? That's the hard part, right? Because we can refuse to not load a gun, right? That's the easy thing.
The book Stride Towards Freedom, The Montgomery Story, was Dr. King's memoir about the bus boycotts. One afternoon in 1958, while signing copies of the book at Blumstein's department store in Harlem, New York, a well-dressed woman stepped out of line, and she yelled, "Is this Martin Luther King?" Dr. King replied, "Yes, it is." The woman, Isola Curry, then pulled a letter opener out of her purse. It had a 7-inch blade. She stabbed it into Dr. King's chest. He was just 29, and the injury was serious. A photographer captured a picture of the surprisingly composed Dr. King sitting in the chair after the incident. The photo shows the letter opener still sticking out of his chest. He later reflected on this incident.
In his final speech in 1968, he reflects on what had happened 10 years prior. And he had said, you know, when that happened, it almost punctured his aorta. If he had sneezed, the doctor had said it, that if he had sneezed, he would have bled out. And so in the great tradition of Baptist ministers, he goes on this riff of, if I had sneezed, I would have missed the sit-ins. If I had sneezed, I would have missed 1963 March on Washington. I would have missed Birmingham. I would have missed Selma. So this was a profound moment for him because it could have altered our course of the understanding of this man tremendously.
You know, it's amazing to hear that speech and to know what happened the next day. He reflected on his life the day before he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel.
That speech was largely improvised. that he wasn't feeling well that day. He had been doing a lot of travel from, 1967 into 1968. At that point, he was arguably the most despised man in America, according to polling data. And he was working tirelessly on the Poor People's Campaign, which was his call to radically reimagine how the United States dealt with the issue of poverty, that it is not a moral wrong on the part of the individual, but the result of systems and inequities. And so he was just exhausted. And so Ralph Abernathy had gone to Mason Temple on his behalf. And when he got there and saw thousands of people there, said, "Hey, Martin, you got to get over here." So Dr. King hops in a cab, takes the 5-minute drive over to Mason Temple and delivers the speech. And it's a very stormy night. And so you can just imagine him delivering this very prophetic and powerful speech. And the shutters on the window, because the winds were so violent, are clapping and smacking as he's reflecting on the moments of his career. He not only talks about what he would have missed and the work forward, but he talks about issues for economic equity, investing in Black banks, supporting Black workers on several levels. So this is a pretty radical statement, and the audience was really enthralled. And many said that it was they had never seen him like that before in his life.
The next day, he wakes up at the Lorraine Motel.
He's hanging out at the Lorraine Motel pretty much all day, April 4th. Hangs out with his brother, calls his mother. There was a injunction on the march that they were trying to have in Memphis. That gets lifted. So he's in good spirits, and he's supposed to go to the home of Reverend Billy Kiles at that evening. And he's in the courtyard, and he is talking to his driver, and it said, "Hey, you know, do you think I need my coat?" And he said, "You know what, Doc, you better, you know, you probably shouldn't." As he's going up to his room, he sees Ben Branch, a well-known saxophone player, and says, "Hey, Ben, tonight I want you to pray Precious Lord and play it real pretty." Mr. Branch says, "You know, I will, Doc." And that's kind of the last things that were said. He shot at 6:01 p.m. The final, the first calls to emergency services come in at 6:04. A lot of people don't realize that back in the 60s and earlier, phones went through switchboards and were connected that way. So Mrs. Lori Bailey was on the switchboard when the call came in for the ambulance and connected them to emergency services. She suffers a cerebral hemorrhage, brain hemorrhage that evening, and goes into a coma and passes away several days later. Dr. King is taken to St. Joseph's Hospital, where he's pronounced dead at 7:30 p.m. And in reaction to his death, famously Walter Cronkite breaks in the news with this announcement, and there are uprisings across the country. The news hits the world, and people are stunned. People are outraged. One of the common themes is, despite people's criticism of Dr. King, he was a man of peace. And how could a man of peace be killed in such a violent and tragic fashion?
His death was announced by Senator Robert F. Kennedy in Indianapolis, Indiana. He said, "I have bad news for you, for all of our fellow citizens, and for people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight." He went on to say that what we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence or lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion towards one another, and a feeling of justice towards those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or they be Black.
You know, and I think the lesson in that is there are moments that mark history, right? There are moments of tragedy, moments of violence that mark history. And yes, we absolutely need to mourn them, walk through the path of grief, which is extensive. For that, we need to honor those moments and hold the places of where those acts happen as sacred, as reminders of what was lost and the sacrifices made. But the other side of that is that there's also power and hope in that, right? That how do you choose to counter that? What is your reaction to that? Robert Kennedy gives his speech announcing it to a crowd in Indianapolis, Indiana, right? And so what's there for us to learn, particularly in the in what we're seeing happening in the country right now, is yes, the country's been through similar tough times before, but we can navigate through this. We have to have the courage and bravery to call out the injustice when we see it, to demand that there be accountability and consequences for actions that violate the law, and to push forth this path for social justice. You know, we cannot change the past as it happens, but we can learn from it, and we can then put those lessons into our present.
You can't help but wonder what Martin Luther King would think of the world today.
I think Dr. King would be very disappointed. He wouldn't be surprised because, you know, he lived through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, right? So there are some things that wouldn't surprise him. I think he would be disappointed. But one of the great things that he talks about is, you know, we can disagree, but we can disagree civilly, right? And the laws of the country, the law can't make someone stop hating you, but it can stop them from lynching you, right? And so as we're facing this fight for social justice and economic equity, there are still some real critical changes we can do. And there is a place for governance within this social change that, yes, morally, you can't make someone love me. And I acknowledge that, but you can stop him from doing me, right? You can make sure that I'm able to take care of my family, that I have a livable wage, I have a livable income, you know, that there shouldn't be any children in this country that are starving. You know, we can keep families together on multiple levels, right? There are issues that we can deal with. And so I think that his words still have relevance today. And I think that if he were to be in the space today, he would call us to be recommitted to those actions. There's a great quote that of Dr. King's that I love that says, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him," right? That there are actions by people who we disagree with, but just because their act is egregious to us, and sometimes it's a threat to our very livelihood, I'm not going to lie, it's a threat to our person, but being able to commit to an act of love, to respond to that hate with a positive, productive means, that means acknowledging when someone does something wrong, right? And saying that you must be held accountable, but also saying this is how we create change in our community, and this is the alternative to these actions. Those are other ways that you can put that out into the universe.
All right. When we come back, we will learn a little bit more about the Lorraine Motel, the site of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. We'll also check back in with the Rosa Parks Museum right after this. And welcome back. Thank you for listening to Learning More, and also thank you for subscribing. Each week, we're going to bring you a new story about people, inventions, pop culture, and life. This week, we are discussing Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Now, here's the interesting thing about Martin Luther King Jr. He was actually born under a different name.
Yeah, his father changes his name in 1934 after traveling to Germany and learning about a Protestant reformer, Martin Luther. And so he changed his name and his son's name. So family and some friends were still calling him Mike throughout his life.
Okay, so this is Dr. Noel Trent from the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel. This is the site of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Let's learn a little more about the history of the Lorraine Motel.
In 1945, African-American business couple Walter and Lori Bailey purchased the motel, renamed it the Lorraine after Mrs. Lori Bailey, as well as the Nat King Cole song, Sweet Lorraine. And it very quickly became one of the key spaces for African-American travelers traveling throughout the country. In segregated America, not every place, even if it was in the North or outside of the South, would welcome African-American travelers. And so there was a book entitled The Green Book that would guide people to safe places to stay. And so the Lorraine Motel was one of them. The motel hosted people like Aretha Franklin, Sam Cooke, Satchel Paige, Jackie Robinson, and many others. Artists from the Stax music label, which isn't too far from the motel, would come and swim in the pool. The motel before this moment had this amazing life and energy. And it was a place that was used to hosting dignitaries and people associated with the civil rights movement, and hosted Dr. King a couple of times before the fateful day on April 4th, 1968.
Yes, that was the day that he was assassinated. Let's talk about the third Monday in January, where we all honor the achievements of Martin Luther King Jr. How did that day come about?
Well, one of the things I like to tell people as we look at the MLK holiday, as we've come to know it, is that a lot of credit, and justifiably, has gone to Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, who introduced the first legislation and did the first proposal in about June of 1968. And he, along with the Congressional Black Caucus, did a lot of work in creating petitions and getting over 6 million signatures in support of the holiday. But a large portion of this work is actually due to Mrs. Coretta Scott King. And she goes unacknowledged in a lot of capacities. She's the one who founds the King Center in June of 68. So just a couple months after her husband is brutally murdered, she has the foresight to form the Center for Nonviolence and is beginning to deliberately shape his legacy. So she's going around the country. She testifies in front of Congress in the 70s to talk about the importance of having a King holiday. The final draft of the legislation is introduced in 1983 by Congresswoman Katie Hall of Indiana, and President Reagan would sign it later that year, making the King holiday, the third Monday in January, the Martin Luther King federal observance of his birthday. It would not be officially celebrated until 1986. An interesting thing to know is that between 1986 and the year 2000, a lot of states still were not observing the King holiday. And so it wasn't until 2000 when South Carolina actually made it a paid holiday. And the state of New Hampshire was the last one to do any sort of observance of the King holiday, that all 50 states were actually observing the King holiday as a full, you know, holiday you take time off. In 1994, President Clinton signed legislation brought forth by Congressman John Lewis and Senator Harris Warford, designating the King holiday as a national day of service.
So if you did do some service on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, awesome. But you know what? You can help out every single day. As we record this, it's during the COVID-19 pandemic and shutdowns and restrictions, and it's tough to get help, especially for some nonprofits.
Nonprofits in general are facing a lot of challenges. And so I think looking at, you know, a nonprofit you care about, one that you want to invest some time in, either locally or nationally, and finding out what they need, right? Sometimes people are like, well, we'll donate food. But sometimes, you know, I will say this, the monetary donations, regardless of how big or small, are always appreciated. But there may be something else that you can do. They may need people to help, you know, drive things from one place or the other.
And service is not just about volunteering for nonprofits. It's also about contributing to your community.
Everyone has suffered great losses in the last year through the pandemic. And just being a neighbor, being kind to someone, is part of that actual act.
And, you know, learning more about Dr. Martin Luther King and his mission and his message is also important. You can go to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, or visit them. They do have some virtual experiences right now because the museum is currently closed because of the COVID situation.
Yeah, we miss our visitors, and we really do appreciate everyone who has supported us during this difficult time. We can't wait to welcome you back, and we look forward to seeing each and every visitor when we're back open.
There'll be a link to the National Civil Rights Museum in the podcast description. You can also go to civilrightsmuseum.org to participate in some of those virtual tours. Thank you, Dr. Noelle Trent from the National Civil Rights Museum, for helping us learn more about Martin Luther King Jr. Now, let's head back to Rosa Parks Museum, where Madeline Burkhart, the curator, earlier, she told us about the arrest of Rosa Parks and the bus boycotts. Well, what happened to Rosa Parks after the boycotts ended?
In 1957, she actually moved out of Montgomery to Detroit, Michigan, because she and Raymond were getting so many death threats. They still faced a lot of adversity there. It was hard for her to find a job. What I've heard is that the CEO of Little Caesars is the one who financially helped them out for a while until she finally got a job.
Wow, that's great. And she also did do some speaking engagements and things like that, right?
Speaking engagements all throughout the country. She did come back down to Montgomery for the march from Selma to Montgomery, which was 10 years later. She also helped organize the Women's March on Washington, which happened at the same time as the famous March on Washington. However, sexism was very alive and well in the 60s, and so the women weren't allowed to march with the men. She also helped Planned Parenthood. She was on the board for Planned Parenthood. She also worked with sexual assault investigations and on domestic violence issues. So before the boycott began, she was actually the sexual assault investigator for the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP.
Rosa Parks did so much in her life, and you can learn more about Rosa Parks at the Rosa Parks Museum at Troy University. They've got a kind of a long website, so I'll put a link to the website in the description of the podcast so that you can go there. And they do have some virtual tours that they've done. They did a couple on Zoom. I checked them out. They were really cool. And there are some other things that you can do at the museum virtually, right?
We also are taking like quote-unquote reservations from schools or just organizations that want a live one, or we will send them a recording and we'll do a live Q&A with them later.
Oh, wow, that's great. So if you've got a school or somebody that wants to tour the Rosa Parks Museum, you can do so. But do visit the website and check out some of the other virtual experiences that you can have there. And then also, don't forget to check out the National Civil Rights Museum as well. I want to thank both of my guests, Dr. Noelle Trent and Madeline Burkhart, for joining me today to discuss Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. Be sure to subscribe to Learning More. We will have a new episode each and every Monday. So be sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you'd like to support us, visit us on Patreon at patreon.com/xaudio. And if you'd like to learn more about a specific topic, you can make a suggestion by going to our website at learningmorepodcast.com. You can also see our other podcasts, including the daily podcast, This Is Today. Hey, we do our best to present all of the correct information within the podcast, as do our guests. So if we made a mistake and you heard it, you're super smart, and we're super sorry. This has been an X Audio podcast production. I'm Russ, and I'll talk to you next week.